So I'll be talking about magnetized disks and perhaps, if I have time, some polarized signatures of those things. Primarily in the beginning of my talk, I'll talk about how strong magnetic fields affect disks. And that work is in collaboration with Sasha Chikovskoy and Ramesh Narayan, as well as Roger Blanford and some others. And if I have time, as I said, I'll talk about polarization with work by Roman Shcherbakov and hopefully future work with these other people. So when I made this talk, I was actually quite pessimistic in the end. I didn't really like what I had been saying because it makes it hard to do stuff with the Event Horizon Telescope. It's too many options, too many dirty astrophysics, as we call it. So, and then I was maybe comforted by Voltaire saying, doubt is an uncomfortable condition, but certainty is a ridiculous one. So I kind of felt that was good, but that's a bad attitude, right? So I think a better attitude would be something by Shakespeare. Our doubts are traitors and make us lose the good we oft might win by fear to attempt. So the basic idea is that we should move forward with fearless doubt. That's the idea. That's the plan for my talk. So as Shep mentioned, one of the targets of the Event Horizon Telescope is M87 and its gorgeous jet. This is on sort of subparsec scales by Walker using VLBA. And what's interesting about this is that this is showing sort of a radio bright region and sort of an extended tail. And I can actually have a movie of this. It's amazing. If you overlap all the movies, all the images, you can see something that looks like this. And the questions this sparks are, well, what's powering this emission? What is the dominant source of the power? And is it, for example, the black hole that's driving a jet of some kind, a powerful jet from a, say, black hole near region, say, the ergosphere that Sergey Kamysov will talk about? Maybe it's a disk around the black hole that's powering this thing. Maybe it's neither, or maybe it's both. All of these things are possible. We really aren't sure. We kind of know that we must have an M87 and Sagittarius A star, something like this as a cartoon. We have to have some kind of accretion disk, which has turbulence, now known to be probably driven by the magnetorotational instability that drives the turbulence. And it brings in magnetic fields that can then lie on the black hole and extract the rotational energy of that black hole spin, slowing down the black hole spin and ejecting power from that energy. So this is a generic picture. There can be winds from the disk, all sorts of interesting things, but while this cartoon looks somewhat simple, it's deceptively simple because there's a lot of different options of how you do things. One of those options is the sort of classic picture of how disks and jets work. This is a sort of picture by McDonald and Thorne. And the basic idea is that you have some kind of disk material which has magnetic fields sort of alternating in a turbulent way, but maybe the black hole is sort of like a vacuum cleaner. It sort of stretches out the field lines, it sucks matter in or ejects it out in a jet, cleaning those magnetic field lines, stretching them out and providing some kind of ordered flux, ordered magnetic field, and that ordered magnetic field might be able to do something with that black hole, which I'll explain in a second. It can actually extract the energy of the black hole. Now, the problem with this picture is it's sort of a copy and paste approach. It took what we know has to be some kind of viscous, turbulent process on a disk, which is driving accretion, allowing angular momentum to be sucked out of the system, with another model, which is called the Blambers-Nyack model, of how to thread magnetic fields through the black hole and extract its energy, also transferring momentum in that way from the black hole. So this is the entire system of magnetic fields extracting momentum from the system, but this is a copy and paste approach because the Blambers-Nyack solution and sort of the disk picture have been disjoint. They haven't really been merged until sort of simulations that Charles Gamy and others have done that allow us to understand how all this is really connected. In particular, if you look at the amount of net flux, and you ask, what is the amount of net flux? What is the integral through the black hole surface of the amount of flux? It's actually fairly arbitrary in this kind of picture. It could be a lot compared to what's threading the disk, or very little. It's really unsure. And Ramesh Narayan coined this sort of system, and you'll see why in a second, sane, standard, and normal evolution. So just boring evolution, sort of, pretty much. Now, an alternative is the non-boring way, which is so-called MAD, magnetically arrested disk. So you have sane or MAD, which one would you like to be? Well, sometimes being MAD is a little exciting, right? And that's what's happening here. So in the MAD disk, this sort of copy and paste approach is avoided. We actually have a plentiful supply of magnetic flux, which is trapped by the black hole in the disk, and there's no edge, sort of, between the disk and the jet. It's just all as much flux as the system can get. That might sound crazy, but maybe it has some relevance in nature, in particular, especially for Sagittarius A star in M87. So one interesting thing I wanted to mention is, what is this thing called the Blanford-Snyak effect related to extracting energy out of the black hole? So it's pretty simple. You have to start off with something a little bit more complicated than a vacuum. You have to have charged particles floating around to screen the electric field. And I think probably Sergei Komissarov will talk also about that. And basically, you have to have the mass of the black hole, you have to have the spin of the black hole, and you're done as far as the black hole. It's very simple. So Shep, you should be done already, right? But you know, the dirty astrophysics is in the way, and the dirty astrophysics here, sorry, something moved back, is the magnetic field that threads the black hole. And it could have many different shapes and sizes. But roughly speaking, the power output of the black hole due to fields threading it is proportional to the flux squared, the amount of flux threading the black hole squared, times the rotation rate, the angular rotation rate squared of the black hole. This basically goes like spin squared, this term. So the faster you rotate the black hole, the more power you get out, or the more magnetic field you pile into the black hole, the more power you get out. There's an associated torque that just corresponds to changing the spin of the black hole. That goes like 1/(ω) of that. There's actually another way to extract energy out of the black hole. Even if you don't have any charged particles, you just have vacuum, just like in a pulsar case, a neutron star, you can have a misaligned magnetic field threading a black hole, which is spinning vertically, spinning around this axis. And just because of that misalignment, your magnetic field will start to extract the misaligned angular momentum. And it will drive either the magnetic field to align with the black hole spin vector, or if it's very strong magnetic field, the black hole will eventually have to align itself with the magnetic field. And this actually has a very similar form, but it only depends upon not the aligned component of the spin, but the opposite part, which is the spin that's aligned with the magnetic field. Of course, things can get much more complicated. There's a third way to get energy out of a black hole, sort of, out of a black hole. In this case, you imagine that now we not only have not vacuum, not charged particles, but we have currents that are flowing, pretty strong currents, which generate field lines that could thread the black hole, but it may also thread the disk. And at the interface between these two, you have what's called a null point or a current sheet. And in a current sheet, you can have magnetic reconnection. And near a black hole, it can be quite fast. And if you have magnetic reconnection, that can dissipate and destroy all that magnetic energy and launch it into thermal energy or kinetic energy. So it turns out that if you ask yourself, if you have this magnetic flux that's accumulated near a black hole, and you allow for a field reversal, then it turns out that the power roughly scales like magnetic flux squared times the reconnection rate, Vr. Reconnection rate is probably something like 0.1, the speed of light, something like that. The key thing, though, is that it does not depend on spin. That is, this is a mechanism by which you can actually extract energy out of the system, but you're extracting energy out of the magnetic field, not the black hole. It turns out, Sasha Chkovskoy showed that this magnetic flux is very weakly dependent on spin. That means that this really doesn't depend on spin at all. That means if you want to get out jets and light up the system, for example, in M87 or other systems, you may not have to have spin at all. You're just tapping the reservoir of magnetic flux through flipping a field. So then it comes to a bunch of acronyms. So astrophysicists love acronyms. It's been around for a long time. And so Ramesh Narayan introduced MAD. This is magnetically arrested disk. It's the idea is that the magnetic field is balancing somehow against the inflow. He had the standard and normal evolution. This is sort of to oppose the MAD state, where you might have like something like a weak field, which is maybe has a single magnetic loop or multiple magnetic loops, something like that. Now, another approach that you could take, which I've done as well, is you could do something sanest, the most sane thing you can do. And that is you actually have standard normal evolution starting with a purely toroidal field, just a toroidal field. What that means is instead of introducing poloidal fields that would eventually be on the black hole and thread the black hole, it's somehow shifting, you start with no ordered poloidal field. You allow the turbulence to generate all of that poloidal field. So you start off a purely wound field around the spin axis of the black hole, and all of the poloidal field that will produce your jet is created spontaneously. So that's like the sanest approach. Now, there's another way you can do one more thing, pretty much. You can have same, which is basically doing the exact same thing as all these, but just misalign the black hole spin with the disk, or the magnetic field with the black hole spin, something like that. And there's the last one, which is Zen. So this is thinking about my supervisors and what they've told me over the years. This would be the zero explicit nepotism model. So this is where I don't care about what anybody believes or thinks astrophysically or theoretically about what should be true. We need the simplest model that doesn't have any assumptions. And so maybe you could start off with a Gaussian random field spectra for the vector potential, for densities and velocity, and just make it consistent with the large scale observations of the temperature and density. But is that really the best thing to do? You know, it sounds nice to be in a Zen state. I want to be there. But it's not a very relevant thing, because if we actually look out in nature and say, say star, for example, we think we look at the galactic center and we see these sort of polarized threads. We see these large scale magnetic threads which are highly polarized. And there's also the interstellar medium which is polarized. And if we ask ourselves, how much magnetic flux is coherent over scales within the interstellar medium or in these threads? And it turns out that even if that coherent patch of field, only 1/1,000,000,000th of that patch reaches the black hole in the galactic center, it's enough to reach the MAD state. That is, it's terribly easy to reach the MAD state in these kinds of systems because the accretion rate is so low, even the tiniest magnetic field will push back on that accretion flow. So it may be quite easy to reach the so-called MAD state. And so maybe these other ones that are more sane or happy aren't actually relevant. Maybe we do live in a mad world. So let's go mad. So I'm going to talk about a simulation which studies this particular state, the MAD state. And now we not only have we don't have vacuum, we have more than that. We have particles, we have currents. We'll also assume that there's an internal energy, a heat content to the gas. This is called a so-called fluid approximation or magnetohydrodynamics in full GR. And we look at various black hole spins, which will determine how powerful this jet might be. We make sure we're talking about radiatively inefficient flow, like applicable to Sagittarius star and M87. And we make sure, you know, we're doing everything reasonable numerically. So this is sort of going to start, and I'll talk about it a little bit. So in this panel, we have density is blue. Eventually, red will be the highest density of gas density. This is z, the vertical distance, and x. This is in the equatorial plane. This is y and x. So here we're looking at a slice through the equator. Here we're looking through a slice vertically. And you can already see that some magnetic field has piled onto the black hole, and the gas density has increased. You can see the highest densities are near the black hole, the red parts. And we have diagnostics which measure things as a function of time. Just focus on the red lines here. This is the mass accretion rate as a function of time. You can see it becomes pretty steady, so we reach a steady state eventually. There's something else that takes a little bit longer to reach a steady state. This is the magnetic flux in the black hole, properly normalized somehow. And you can see that it takes a while for this red line or red dot to reach the saturation point, at which point it does saturate. What's interesting about this is that this is reaching a state where it can't get, the black hole can't get any more magnetic flux. The magnetic flux has piled up to its maximum, and this is the red line here is the magnetic flux on the black hole itself. It can't get any more. Even though there's a plentiful supply, it stops growing because it fights back. Finally, the magnetic field pushes back. And once that happens, once you reach this maximum amount of magnetic flux, you look at your so-called black hole efficiency. How efficient is the system? That is, what is the power output of the black hole for the input that you've given it? And it turns out that it's more than 100% efficient. And Sasha Chkovskoy is the first one that showed this actual so-called net energy extraction. This is the process whereby you're actually getting more energy out than you put in. Now, how can that happen? Well, there's the stored energy of the black hole. That's how it's happening. You're not actually, you're sort of paying back. You're getting more from what was put in before. So another interesting aspect is you can ask, well, if you're in this mad state, what could happen? It turns out that near the black hole, if there's sufficient magnetic flux, you can introduce new kinds of processes, magnetic torques, for example. It was usually thought that the only way to sort of twist a disk was through a process called Bardeen-Petterson effect. It's basically where you have lens-theoring precession torques, which sort of get viscously dissipated and spread out angular momentum, so it releases misaligned angular momentum and aligns the disk with the black hole spin. Turns out if you have magnetic fields that are strong, this also aligns the black hole with a disk. And so I'll show a simulation of that, basically the same kind of simulation as before, but I'm now looking at various tilts with respect to the black hole. And here I'll look at the extreme case of a very misaligned tilt. The black hole spin is going to be initially pointing up with the disk going around it, and eventually I'm just going to artificially twist the black hole spin by 90 degrees, and we're going to see what happens. So initially it started off all aligned. The disk material is rotating around in orange. The blue is the jet. And everything is nice and aligned. About 30 seconds through, I'm going to flip the black hole spin to the right, make it go like this. And one question is, well, first of all, can the jet survive this process? If you have some kind of misaligned, somehow it keeps on going forward. Hopefully it doesn't do it again. If I have this misaligned system, can I still produce a jet? Because you imagine if the black hole spin is pointing into the disk, how can a jet get out? Well, these magnetic torques are very strong, and eventually the disk will start to rotate with the black hole spin again. Hopefully it doesn't switch. So you can see it's a very complicated system. Now I've switched the spin. It's along this direction. And we're going to see whether or not the black hole jet will survive. And it does survive, and eventually, after some time scale, realigns with the black hole spin. And these are just through these magnetic torques that I discussed in the beginning of the talk. So I think I have one more minute, roughly, before questions. Thank you. So I just very briefly discussed polarization. Once you've looked at these mad systems, these sane systems, you can ask, what observational thing will I expect? Well, one thing you can ask is about polarization. And that's interesting because you have all these different magnetic fields. Maybe the polarization will tell you something about which magnetic field is right in these two systems, Sagittarius A star and M87. Well, these are a collection of data from various observations for, say, the flux as a function of frequency, linear polarization as a function of frequency, circular polarization as a function of frequency. I'll just focus on these two for time. These are the observations, roughly. You can go out and for one of those sane models, you can ask, what do you get? Well, these are the same data points for the actual observations, the blue dots, the blue line, the blue dots, the blue dots. Those are the observations that we can trust. And then we have various models at various spins for different colors. And I guess the takeaway point is that roughly speaking, the flux is the easiest thing to fit. It turns out that fitting also these polarized quantities is a challenge. So that means that polarization adds an extra constraint that's not otherwise going to be obvious. And if you have a model that works without polarization, it's very possible that if you include a polarization, it will no longer work. And the very last thing I'll mention is these questions. So generally, is anything really constrained? We have so many different models, magnetic field geometries, possible ways to power the jet. There's the disk, there's the black hole, there's magnetic reconnection, which has nothing to do with the spin. Seems that polarization helps. At least it's starting to make some models not fit. That's great. You can't fit our models. That's a good thing. What kind of magnetic field do we have? Is there sort of a warp or bend near the black hole? Maybe that needs to be accounted for the Event Horizon Telescope observations. We obviously need better simulations, larger radial ranges when we simulate them. Are we actually seeing a disk or a jet when we see some of these systems, especially in Sagittarius A star? What is the actual thing that we're seeing? Maybe it's really a jet and not a disk. And of course, there's several other kinds of physics that I didn't talk about. For the polarization, we only include thermal particles. Maybe you need non-thermal particles. You probably need compensation and pair production. Maybe Charles might talk about that. He also might talk about non-ideal MHD, thermal conduction, and I think Elliot will also talk about that. But those are the kind of things that we're struggling with. Thank you. Yes, so this is synchrotron. Yes.
And what assumptions did you make about particle productions?
About what production?
Particles. About relativistic electrons.
Not being produced, just whatever's in the simulation, whatever their energy density is, that's partitioned into electrons and protons. I can discuss after the fact how we split that up. But
it should be non-thermal particles.
Yeah, so here we assume thermal.
Highly energetic particles.
Yeah, here we assume thermal, and of course, non-thermal particles are crucial, so that'll have to be done soon.
I wonder a little bit, I'm an observer, and I know also the work of Blanford and Payne and later other people. To what extent is your assumption of a more or less homogeneous magnetic field in the beginning, which you then just twist, not already putting in what you want to get out? I mean, at some point, the big question is, what is the dominant process? Is it BZ or BP?
Right.
And I wonder, perhaps, if the combination of the two might be the better approach, because the disk itself is also probably highly ionized, therefore it's magnetic. And it puts in a wind, and which is gradually transported to the black hole. So how can we discriminate which of the two processes is the more relevant?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think Sasha Shkovskaya has worked on understanding the contribution and power of the wind or a jet from the disk or a black hole as a function of spin. For low spins, it seems like the disk does dominate. For high spins, the black hole dominates. That's assuming a mad state. If you have any other magnetic field, the black hole might be, like, if the field is very weak, the black hole won't dominate. To tell the difference, it's a great question. One of the things that we're trying to understand is where's the emission coming from? And like Sergey mentioned, we need non-thermal particles. And some people are doing that. You'll probably hear Jason Dexter and Avery and Charles and others talk about that. For the disk, it's pretty self-consistent as far as what Lorentz factor is got, and it's roughly a V over C of a third, which is, you know, not too relativistic, under-relativistic. The jet can be any value you want in the simulations. It's sort of just set by how low you let the density go. One needs a better prescription for that, which maybe somebody like Charles Gamy might talk about as well. So that's a free parameter in these models, but one needs to do better to constrain the Lorentz factor more generally. For parts. Yeah. Well, let's discuss that afterwards. Yeah.